Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. National Geographic magazine is renowned for its photographs, and the November 2017 issue is no exception. The heartbreaking photos that accompany the story, Why Vaccines Matter, do what they're supposed to do, break through our disinterest in people who live far away, in people who may not look like us or live like us. The title page shows a father carrying his four-year-old daughter, one leg withered from polio, the other leg in a cast after it was broken by a car she couldn't dodge. The next photo shows a red motorbike with a large blue cooler on top loaded into a canoe-like wooden barge during the 10-hour journey to bring vaccine to villages in the Democratic Republic of Congo during a measles outbreak. Many more gorgeous photos by William Daniels illustrate how children in poor nations often go without the vaccines that rich nations take for granted. It was a little after dawn in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, and Saha was in the back seat of his car brooding. A uniformed driver threaded the Toyota through a cacophonous mess of jitneys, motorcycles, rickshaws, trucks, and battered buses with passengers hanging out the doors. "We could save the life, but we could not," he left the sentence unfinished. "You'll be seeing the scenario," he said. "You'll understand." Saha is a microbiologist, internationally renowned for his research on a bacterium called pneumococcus. The laboratory he founded is wedged into one corner of Dhaka Shishu, the biggest children's hospital in Bangladesh. Just down the hall, rows of beds fill the open wards. During family hours, each bed seems to hold both a sick child and many attentive relatives. Inside the lab, white-jacketed men and women spend their days in intimate study of pneumococcal cells, hunting for them in vials of blood and other bodily fluids, smearing them into petri dishes, peering at them through microscopes. Pneumococcal bacteria are ubiquitous in the modern world. Easily spreadable through sneezing or casual contact, they can live without ill effect in the nasal passages of people with healthy immune systems. But when our defenses fail us, pneumococcus can migrate, multiply, and set off life-threatening infectious disease. Young children are especially vulnerable. Young children in places without ready access to antibiotics and good medical care are the most vulnerable of all. At the start of the 21st century, as the world's first effective children's vaccine became available in the United States and Canada, pneumococcal disease was killing more than 800,000 children worldwide every year. More than 750,000 infants and kids under five, that is, dying not from some headline epidemic like Ebola or Zika, but from a common organism that blew up into pneumonia, infected lungs, or meningitis, infected brain lining, or a mortal assault on the bloodstream. The vast majority of those deaths were occurring in impoverished countries such as Bangladesh. In 2015, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, as the children's formulation is called, reached the Bangladeshis, and Saha's research team is intently tracking its progress. If PCVs prove as effective around the world as vaccine experts hope, they promise both a greatly lowered mortality rate — that's many thousands of small children staying alive instead of dying before they're old enough to start school — and much less non-mortal sickness. Less of the rapid pneumonia breathing, less of the fever, the sucking chest, the rattling cough, the blue lips, the bedside watch by parents pulled away from the paid work that supports their other children. Less suffering. I kept hearing Saha and his Bangladeshi colleagues say, as though sensing that an outsider might need help appreciating the stakes. Because from the vantage of a country like the United States, it can be easy to imagine that the most pressing vaccine challenge of 2017 lies in convincing certain communities of skeptical parents that they really ought to inoculate their kids. Those efforts are important, to be sure, but even more urgent, more ambitious, more complex, involving many governments and billions of philanthropic dollars, is the international collaboration to get new vaccines to children in the developing world, where to this day the suffering caused by vaccine-preventable disease is as vivid and non-theoretical as the frantic families Saha sees every day in the halls of Dhaka Shishu. This is why he was sending me to Sanjida Saha Jahan, 11 years old, the middle child of a rickshaw repairman and his wife. Sanjida, who had been carried into Dhaka Shishu at the age of 3 with what turned out to be pneumococcal meningitis, was propped up in a small plastic armchair beside the family bed. Meningitis is an inflammation, sometimes irreversibly destructive, of the membranes that surround the brain and spinal cord. Sanjida has no control over her head, her grimaces, or the sounds she makes, mewling cries mostly as she's unable to form words. Her mother, Nazma, had been outside with the baby when we arrived. In these rooms, 9 families share 2 toilets and a single tap. And now Nazma hurried in, holding the baby in one arm, wiping dry her face. She lowered herself onto a stool. She took Sanjita's hand. In Bangla, she told us the story. Their bright, talkative 3-year-old's unexplained fever, the neighbors urging acetaminophen for sale in a shop nearby, the fever receding after the pills, the fever rising again. A few days later came the first convulsion and the terrified journey to the hospital by bus and motorcycle taxi, as a rickshaw repairman doesn't have the means to summon an ambulance. By the time doctors saw Sanjida, she was losing consciousness. Her last understandable words, Nazma said, were, "Hug me. I feel very bad." Sanjida's father, Mohammed, pulled from a drawer a creased yellow card, Sanjida's national health record. Here was her birth date in September 2005. And here, the first markings dated 6 weeks later, were the notations for Sanjida's vaccinations. Like her older brother, Sanjida received every inoculation then in Bangladesh's national immunization plan, on schedule and for free. Whooping cough, measles, diphtheria, tuberculosis, tetanus, hepatitis B, polio. No smallpox. Worldwide vaccination had already erased that disfiguring contagion from the planet by 1980. 2 centuries after the English physician Edward Jenner published his famous treatise on deliberately infecting children with cowpox, a mild virus, that turned out to stimulate immunity against the far more serious smallpox. An extraordinary global health history had been abbreviated in a way on Sanjida's little yellow card. No one can tally accurately the total number of lives saved by widespread vaccination, but it remains one of the greatest achievements of modern medicine. Measles, for example, was killing more than 2 million children a year worldwide in the 1980s. By 2015, according to the World Health Organization, vaccination had dropped the death toll to 134,200. Mass vaccination has ended polio in all but 3 countries. Bangladesh and its giant neighbor India were pronounced polio-free in March 2014. On television, the Saha Jahans is crammed in atop that wall cabinet. Popular singers and athletes in public service ads praise the life-saving gift of inoculation. Encouragements to vaccinate trumpet from thousands of minarets, like calls to prayer. Bangladesh is predominantly Muslim, and while pushing for polio inoculation in the late 1980s, health officials and Islamic leaders together came up with a plan for mosque miking. Once, in a village outside Dhaka, the local imam proudly pushed up a sleeve to show me the trace of his last tuberculosis vaccination. Protecting one's health is part of a religiously observant life, he explained, and faithful parents are obliged to do the same for their children. Delivering vaccines in Bangladesh isn't easy. The terrain is crisscrossed by flooding rivers and barely passable roads, and the vaccines must be kept at just the right cold temperature to preserve their potency. Maintaining this cold chain is an urgent priority for immunization programs in all countries with hot climates and shaky power grids. A single faulty chiller or a rural power outage can wreck a whole batch of vaccine. But Bangladesh has worked hard to preserve the cold chain, equipping local health centers with solar panels, pressing bicycles and river boats into service to ferry vaccines to the most remote clinics. The Bangladeshi inoculation program is widely respected for its remarkable reach. In fact, and on the way back to Dhaka Shishu, the three of us silent and sad in the hospital van, I understood what Samir Saha most wanted me to see. By 2005, when the infant Sanjita got all her shots, the new vaccine against pneumococcal infection was routinely being injected into children all over the United States and was spreading fast across the developed world. The problem was, in places like Bangladesh, which needed the vaccine far more desperately but couldn't pay what the manufacturer had decided to charge. Vaccines, with very few exceptions, are made by private companies in business to return a profit. Until recently, their manufacture worldwide has been dominated by a few U.S. and European pharmaceutical giants. As officials of these companies point out when advocacy organizations like Doctors Without Borders press them to lower their prices, or else open their books to prove why they can't, developing a new vaccine is especially expensive. After all, it typically involves injecting a disabled germ or fragment of a germ into healthy trial participants, followed by a drawn-out process of watching and waiting to make certain the vaccine isn't harmful, that it stimulates an immune response against the infectious germ, and that the people who receive it contract the disease less often than those who don't. All that takes years. For a pneumococcal vaccine that worked right in children, it took decades. Good adult vaccines were on the market by the early 1980s, but they never set off the hoped-for immune response in small kids. It wasn't until the late 1990s that researchers finally found a way to biologically amend or conjugate the contents of those adult vaccines so they would be recognized by immature immune systems. Pneumococcus presents another vexing challenge. Saha and other scientists have identified nearly 100 versions or serotypes of pneumococcal cells. Serotypes can be geographically distinct, and for reasons not yet fully understood, only a small number are dangerous. Serotype 1, for example, causes comparatively little disease in the United States, but is a prime source of pneumococcal illness and death in Africa and South Asia. So a finished vaccine that works for children and targets exactly the right serotypes is really multiple vaccines, individually amended and tested and then mixed into one vial. All these complications helped make the first children's pneumococcal vaccine one of the most expensive in history. Called Prevnar, it was launched in early 2000 by the American pharmaceutical company Wyeth, which was later taken over by Pfizer. It was formulated to work against the 7 serotypes responsible for most of the disease, in the United States, that is, which could absorb a children's vaccine priced at $232 per 4-dose course. Among the dangerous kinds of pneumococcus that vaccine was not formulated to fight off was serotype 1. Yet the poorest regions of Africa and South Asia are precisely where any pneumococcal infection is likeliest to kill a child or leave her crippled for life. Not just because parents can't reach a doctor in time, but also because the bacteria do extra damage inside small bodies already weakened by malnutrition, other lingering diseases, and too much exposure to cookfire smoke. When I started work on this, what kept me up at night was the iniquity, says Oren Levine, vaccine delivery director at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Years ago, a colleague of his watched a woman in a Mali hospital lose a daughter to pneumococcal pneumonia. She'd lost another daughter the same way. Levine still remembers the mother's name. His own daughters were about the same age. The chances of a kid dying of pneumococcal disease in the rich world were 100-fold less, he says. Why was it that my kids could get the vaccine when Timini Diarra's kids, Mali's kids, needed it more and didn't get it? He knew the answer, of course. The surest economic return to vaccine manufacturers doesn't come from meeting the most critical need. Imagine Levine's frustration echoed by a world of vaccine experts, and you understand the impetus behind the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, or Gavi. This multi-billion dollar public-private collaboration got underway in 2000, just as PCVs reached the U.S. market. Kicked off in part by a $750 million pledge from the Gates Foundation, Gavi channels wealthy nations' resources, private philanthropy plus government aid from such countries as the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway into vaccine support for poorer countries that apply for the aid. Gavi helps negotiate with vaccine companies to slash prices specifically for those large volume sales. Subsidies from the donor fund then reduce the cost to developing countries even further so that they pay a small fraction of the usual market price. It's been absolutely transformational. The financial muscle and the dedication that global actors and manufacturers and countries have agreed to, says Catherine O'Brien, a pediatrician and pneumococcus expert who directs the International Vaccine Access Center at Johns Hopkins University. Gavi wasn't assembled just to help with pneumococcal vaccine, O'Brien points out. The alliance concentrated at first on making established childhood inoculations like tetanus and hepatitis B more accessible. PCVs joined the vaccine list only in 2010, after years of continued testing and negotiation. But the demand from developing countries was so high that soon Gavi was devoting a $500 million donor dollars a year to PCV support, the alliance's single biggest financial commitment. With those deals in place, the manufacturers have also developed new formulations that extend the effectiveness of PCVs to include children a long way from US and Europe. In 2010, Pfizer released a new blend called Prevnar 13, designed to work against serotype 1 and five others not targeted in the original mix. The GSK product, introduced in 2009, also is configured to fight serotypes prevalent in Africa and Asia. And since March 2015, when Bangladeshi health officials received their inaugural delivery of Gavi discounted PCV, vaccine shipments have arrived by air freight every 3 months from a GSK distribution center in Belgium. Small chiller boxes, Saha told me, like when you're going camping. But these are a little more sophisticated with monitoring systems for the temperature. The vaccines, health officials say, are reaching families all over the country. Bangladesh, at least so far, has experienced no surge of vaccine hesitancy, as global health experts prefer to call the problem of parents declining to vaccinate their children. Elsewhere in South Asia, suspicion and hostility have troubled recent inoculation campaigns. In Pakistan, for example, polio vaccinators a few years ago were turned away or attacked amid rumors both false and true. False, that the vaccines were part of a Western plot against Islam. True, that the CIA used house-to-house vaccinators to hunt for Osama bin Laden. And in parts of India, a measles rubella vaccination campaign foundered earlier this year after anonymous posts on social media claimed the vaccines were dangerous or even meant to sterilize the children of religious minorities. Even in vaccine-receptive Bangladesh, Saha told me he's heard people wonder about the merits of adding PCVs to the already ambitious national inoculation effort. I was on a talk show on the TV, he said. A banker's wife, a powerful person, said, "Why are you talking about vaccines so much? Pneumonia and other pneumococcal infections are treatable with penicillin," the banker's wife objected. Saha had just said so himself. And my answer was, "Oh, madam, you want to wait until pneumonia develops, and then you should treat it?" Had she walked the Dhaka Shishu wards with Saha, this woman would have seen listless children lying under oxygen masks, the families gathered at their bedside or crowded somberly in the hallways, waiting for antibiotics to take hold. And those are the families who've made it to the hospital. For the remotest places, Saha said, this, the preemptive strike of a working vaccine, is the only tool we have. In the villages and poorest city slums, pneumococcus-sickened children still die by the thousands at home. Sanjita Sahajahan made it to Dhaka Shishu, but doctors could do little for her. Saha carries special frustration about her case. His lab identified the pneumococcus that infected her brain, serotype 1, one of the varieties not targeted in the original version of Prevnar. So even if Bangladesh had been able to afford the vaccine in 2005, it would not have protected Sanjita, because the manufacturer had launched a life-saving product not meant for her part of the world. And it's not only that child who is non-functional, Saha said. The mother is non-functional. She cannot go anywhere. Each and every member of that family is really half dead. The sprawling GSK campus in Belgium is the biggest vaccine production facility in the world. The day I met Luc de Bruin, the company's global vaccines president, I'd already been obliged twice to change clothes. Each vaccine's biological and mixing work is hermetically contained inside its own separate building. And stepping into one of these dedicated structures requires a complete switch to clean room suit, cleansed white shoes and protective goggles and cap over eyeglasses and hair. Those buildings, along with other parts of the company's vaccine operation, represent an investment of more than $5 billion over the past decade, De Bruin said. It is a profitable business, he added. It needs to be profitable to be sustainable, to be able to offer massive volume and affordable pricing to the developing world. The children's pneumococcal vaccine GSK delivers to Dhaka is a global production. Mixing starts at the company's plant in Singapore, vaccine batches are sent to Belgium and then France for processing, and the vials are finally returned to Belgium for shipping. As I peered through those goggles at the great silvery machines and vats, though, the product under preparation was another GSK offering, a vaccine against a pathogen called rotavirus, the leading cause of children's diarrhea, which sickens millions every year. In the poorest countries of sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, it kills by the hundreds of thousands. Many children in Dhaka Shishu are struggling to recover from it. Bangladesh has Gavi approval to start receiving GSK's rotavirus vaccine probably sometime next year. After the negotiated discount and additional financial support, the government will pay about 50 cents for each two-dose course of a vaccine that currently costs an American physician $220. For an impoverished health system, that's irresistible, but there's a colossal catch. Gavi aid is supposed to be temporary, a means for poor countries to help more children grow up healthy, and in doing so, help improve the country's own economies to the point where they can finance important vaccines on their own. Once a recipient country rises above the world's lowest per capita income levels, the Gavi subsidy is supposed to be phased out. It's called transitioning, says Doctors Without Borders vaccine policy advisor Kate Elder. But I've heard ministers of health call this being expelled. Even though leaders of GSK and other major U.S. and European vaccine manufacturers have promised to maintain impoverished country discounts, losing the subsidy still means a comparatively huge cost increase. In Bangladesh, for example, it could push the GSK pneumococcal vaccine cost from 60 cents to $9.15 per child. That still looks like a bargain to an American doctor paying more than 50 times that much. But Doctors Without Borders and other critics argue that the prices big American and European drug companies charge for children's vaccines are unacceptably high, even at a discount. A third of the world's countries have not yet brought PCVs into their immunization programs. A key reason is long-term cost. From the drug companies, Elder says, "We get this a lot of the time. Why aren't you just celebrating the kids who do have access now?" And we say, "Yes, but we want more." One remedy may lie in emerging competition from outside the U.S. and Europe, from pharmaceutical companies in India, Brazil, Vietnam, Cuba, South Korea, and even Bangladesh, where a DACA enterprise now sells nearly a dozen kinds of vaccine, using ingredients shipped in from other countries. An enormous Indian manufacturer called the Serum Institute produces from scratch more than 1 billion doses a year of relatively inexpensive vaccines, shipping them throughout India as well as abroad. Disease experts at the Gates Foundation and PATH, a global health nonprofit also based in Seattle, are helping Serum develop its own children's pneumococcal vaccine. Trials are underway in India and Africa, and that vaccine could be on the market by 2020. Samir Saha is 62 now, with no imminent plans for retirement. It's too soon to assess definitively the success of PCVs in Bangladesh, but the last time we walked through Dhaka Shishu together, he was upbeat. Only 3 pneumococcus patients were in the general ward that day, none appeared in grave danger, and one of Saha's researchers was at a computer working on a bar graph that showed a tantalizing case drop for autumn 2016, one short bar dwarfed by much taller ones from the preceding 6 autumns. Saha pulled up a chair and looked closely at the graph. "Let's wait and see next year," he said, but he was smiling. "Good for the patients," he said. "Less pneumonia in the hospital, less death." He waved his arm toward all the researchers bent over microscopes. "Jobless," Saha joked, and his smile broadened. "All of them will be jobless." And that was written by Cynthia Gorney for the November 2017 National Geographic magazine. Thank you for tuning in to Soundbody today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, WXXI.org.